You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You, in 30 years.
Whoa.
Some advice. Open a Laurel Road checking account when you refinance your student loans. You could get a rate as low as 1.37% variable APR, plus a cash bonus.
I can do that.
Also, don't date Parker.
Ew, the defense attorney?
Trust me.
Save yourself with Laurel Road. Visit laurelroad.com/saveyourself for more information. Rates depend on your credit profile and include discounts. Terms and conditions apply. Laurel Road is a brand of KeyBank, member FDIC.
Episode 157, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today's guest is Dr. Basavanna Gudra. He's faculty at Penn Medicine in Philadelphia. And we're going to talk about board certification after residency. So this is something that is definitely more in the weeds for people who are technically involved, like people who are physicians, because we've all done residency and we have to do board certification. But for those of you who aren't, you might ask yourself, well, I don't know, is this very interesting? And I think you'll find it. What the certification process is really a reflection broadly in most professions of the testing industrial complex. And you'll find that what problems you may have in your profession, where like, you know, you're, let's say you're an electrical engineer or maybe an attorney, you have to pass some sort of test, a bar exam for attorneys. There are other certification tests people have to pass. And there's oftentimes now a push to do this more and more often, rather as opposed to doing it just one time, declaring yourself an expert, passing the, you know, this training program, and then you're sort of off in the world. Now you're expected to continually do re-education or new education, which is absolutely something that is required, because unless your profession is static, meaning there's no change, you need to continue educating yourself. The problem, of course, comes in the fact that it's very broad in these re-education programs, right? And so what happens is, you know, I might be an anesthesiologist specifically, and I do general anesthesia. Well, I don't really need to know the ins and outs of cardiac anesthesia or high-risk pediatrics because I just don't do it. It just never comes across my desk. I never do those cases. And so I'm forced now to relearn things, to find new techniques and things that are going to be of no benefit to my patients. And you might say, well, that's just, you know, goes with the course, that's part of the course. It just kind of goes along with being a doctor. You have to know these things. But think about what the opportunity costs. So if I'm spending time learning about something that I will never do, I'm unable to spend time doing something that matters to me, like my family, or perhaps learning something that I'm doing, like nerve blocks or other things that are going on in the anesthesia field. And so there is a cost to this, even though there might be a technical cost, like, you know, dollars. There's absolutely a cost to training and learning things that are of no benefit to you. Now, when we do our initial training process in anesthesia, you, of course, don't know what you're going to do for sure when you're going to get done with training. So you kind of do learn everything. You see all sorts of things. You get exposed to everything. And that is part of the process, I guess, of training that, you know, you get to see some cardiac anesthesia. You get to see some pediatrics and some neuro. And you say, oh, boy, I don't want to do that, or I do want to do that. I want to spend more time focusing on obstetrics or whatever. And so there is a value to that. And, you know, that's the balance that I guess when you have any sort of training program. But once you're done and you have a career somewhere, you've sort of decided your path. And I wouldn't expect someone who is a specialist and fixes, let's say, semis to be forced to continually learn how to fix motorcycles. It wouldn't make any sense if that's something they never do. But in many ways, that's what we're expected to do in medicine a lot, maybe even more than other professions. I can't speak for them. But I think, you know, if you're not in medicine, it's interesting to see how these things just keep getting ratcheted up and there's no recourse and there's no way for us to complain. I mean, well, because you complain, but there's no way to actually change the process, which is very interesting because this organization that does our credentialing is private, but it's not private, right? So it it sort of has regulatory hold over us, but it has no feedback mechanism where we can actually lodge complaints or actually create any reform if we think there's something that's gone off the rails and it's no longer doing what we think it should be doing. So Dr. Gudra did a study that basically found that one of the new components that are added for anesthesia, which they are adding these new components all the time for initial certification, is of no value. It's phony. It's not something that the residents think is helpful. Residency directors don't think is helpful. And yet it exists. And of course, the reasons you can imagine it exists are because there's financial incentives to keep it going. That's my editorial. Dr. Gudra may has somewhat different ideas, but fairly generally agrees. So I think you'll find an interesting discussion. We're going to get into the weeds a little bit, but I think, you know, you'll find that generally we'll explain a lot of times why your physician friends might be upset and why they might be having problems with burnout and why you've seen people in the last 2 years, we've seen almost 25% people have left medicine. Now, those aren't just physicians and nurses, but these are professionals and people who are the ancillary staff. And you got to ask yourself why they've left medicine. I mean, that's an amazing amount of turnover in the United States. And so there obviously won't be one cause or one reason that people leave. There are multiple reasons. But this is just one of many, and this is one that, you know, could be cleaned up. And so I think that's something we should really look at and recognize when our colleagues have problems or complaints, and maybe there's a way to change these things. And so that's hopefully, as an advocacy, that's what this show is about, to explain to those who are in the business why it's not working the way they want it to, and maybe some people who found solutions. And then for those who are not in the business, kind of what's going on and why, you know, why my family members or why my friends having trouble. So that's what our goal is with the show. I'd like to remind you to go to theparadox.com/157. There you can find links to Dr. Gudra's study, his article in Medscape, and also his other side hobby where he helps people with board questions, both for the general medicine, completing your medical school, and then also for the specialty boards in anesthesia. But without further ado, Dr. Gudra and the Testing Industrial Complex strikes again. Enjoy. Well, hi, I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Basavana Gudra. He's an anesthesiologist at Penn Medicine in Philadelphia. And today we're going to talk about recertification. And so we've talked in the past about board certification and recertification. And today we're going to talk about the certification process in addition to other things that go on with the certification universe, I guess, when it comes to medicine. So Dr. Gudra, thanks so much for joining The Paradox.
You're welcome.
Well, let's get into your article because I found it very interesting. It's something I haven't seen a whole lot of. We've talked about the recertification process, and just, I guess, as a brief primer for those of you who may not remember what we've talked about in the past, there is initial certification, so you finish your residency training, whatever the specialty is, and there is some sort of certification process by the boards, and there are 20 specialty boards, part of the American Board of Medical Specialties, ABMS. And every specialty has their own board. So I'm anesthesia, and so I have the ABA. My wife's a pediatrician. She has the ABP, the American Board of Pediatrics. And they have different components. So they have I think they all have a written component where they have a written test you take. And then they have other things. And so they might have like an oral board, which we had in anesthesia, or they'll have case reports. And so you'll have to go over cases that you've done if you're like a surgeon. And then they'll review those and they'll ask you questions like, why would you do this? What if this had happened? Would you have done things differently? Those sorts of things. And then once you get that, once you pass those components, then you are certified in your specialty. So you're board certified, whatever, anesthesiologist, pediatrician, et cetera. And then now we have this recertification process where every 5 to 10 years, you do new components and do things to actually maintain your certification, because what used to be a lifetime certification process became a time limited. So it would expire and you had to keep doing this current testing. But we're going to talk about the certification process because it is, again, not surprisingly, there are things being added to this. And so Dr. Gudra is an anesthesiologist. And so he conducted a study about for the anesthesia boards because they added a component. Can you briefly describe what the component was they added and what made you, I guess, look into the effectiveness or utility of this new testing program?
Yeah, thank you for asking the question. Yeah, what they introduced is something called objective structured clinical examination. And ABA is the only board out of 24 member boards of the ABMS to introduce this component in 2018. And they did some background research into that, but the research was mostly into the feasibility of holding this exam, because it's a big number. And I'm sure you recall that in the past, I'm sure when you took the exam, it used to be in a hotel, the SOE exams, and which is not the best place to hold these exams, but so be it. And then they moved to their own headquarters. And they probably found, you know, there's enough space and, you know, logistics to conduct this exam. And that's what they initially looked at, which for me kind of surprising in this day and age. One hopes that there'll be, you know, some kind of, you know, pilot study or some kind of way of doing things to see whether it, to do a couple of things. One, this is obviously, you know, like your USMLE clinical skill component, which probably, you know, has been aborted in 2020. They completely stopped it. And this was something similar. And one would hope that in this day and age, they will do some kind of pilot project, not just to see whether this can be just, you know, conducted in a large scale, but whether it adds value. That's one thing. And also, and you know, America is a big country, about 1,500 to 1,600 residents appear for this exam every year. And you have people coming from, you know, all kinds of different parts of the world, you know, different accents, different nationalities that look differently. And they must, or they should have also looked into possible bias in this kind of exam, because the bias has been questioned as far as USMLE clinical skill component. And finally, they, you know, they did get rid of it, because there is enough evidence to show that, I mean, when I contacted the ABA and asked them about how they're addressing potential bias, their answer was, oh, well, everybody gets, you know, unconscious bias training, UBT training. But there is enough data to show that the UBT at best is ineffective, at worst is reinforces the bias. Everybody knows. And especially, you know, in this climate of hyperpolarization, you know, anything is looked through the prism of, you know, some kind of, you know, bias. So I was curious. I mean, I found it a bit odd. They decided to introduce a component that had, you know, potential bias with unproven value into already overburdened exam, because don't forget, not that long ago, they introduced basic exam, which wasn't there before. To make it worse, the basic exam was kind of essential to get to, I think, year three or something. If somebody doesn't pass the basic exam in the first 2 years, they're basically, you know, out of their anesthesia residency. And I certainly know at least one person who, you know, who was asked to leave the specialty and, you know, didn't go very well. I don't want to go into the details of it afterwards. And I mean, looking at multiple factors, and no other ABMS member board had it. Maybe ABA wanted to set an example, you know, as to how we can do differently. Maybe they wanted to prove that we are better than, you know, anesthesiology assistants and CRNAs, that we do something extra. But it doesn't matter what they do. I always thought in this, not just now, even in the past, they must have, you know, made sure, one, this exam is unbiased, and second, it adds value. And in order to achieve these two goals, they should probably have, you know, like, we can do the videos so easily, and they already have the video. Why don't they just sit with the candidate and go through the performance as well? Because at the end of the day, ABA is there to make sure the patients do better. It's all about patient care. That's how they get there, I guess, non-profit exemption, I mean, non-profit organizations. So that wasn't there. And yeah, with this background, I thought, you know, let me just figure out what the residents think about this component. So that was the whole idea. I mean, there were other issues. Some of them are kind of mired in our department, politics. I don't want to go into the details.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So I guess maybe specifically, so it is very, the name is very enigmatic, right? Objective Structured Clinical Examination. What exactly does that mean? So right now, I did a written exam where you test in basic knowledge of, you know, all kinds of anesthesia, whether it's, you know, the vapor pressure, desflurane, or, you know, how a semi-closed system, circle system works or whatever like that. And then you have the oral system where they give you a bunch of scenarios. You sit in a room, someone asks you a question about some case, and then whatever you do is wrong, and the patient just keeps circling the drain and getting sicker and sicker, and you have to try and, you know, find some way of bringing him back, right? So what is this exam? I mean, what exactly were they doing?
It supposedly has 7 components. And 2 of the components are truly objective. I mean, I had to say that. One is identifying some videos and images of transesophageal echocardiogram, which itself is debatable. The reason being that, you know, other than cardiac anesthesiologist, who actually uses it?
Yeah, that's true.
And even if you end up in memorizing some of these videos, and, you know, nowadays you can get pretty much everything on YouTube. Even if you spend some time, you know, looking at these, do the exam, you forget about it unless you use it, right?
Sure.
You use it or lose it. That's typically, you know. At one point, I was probably one of the best regional anesthesiologists before the ultrasound days. And most of the time, I didn't even use a nerve stimulator. The landmark, for example, of supraclavicular block, which was my favorite, was, you know, where the external jugular vein crosses your, you know, clavicle, introduce a needle down there, hit the first rib, and just find your paresthesia and inject. You know, the famous statement from, I think, Dr. Ramanathan from UPIT, who is no more, was that if your needle can't find the nerve, let the drug find it. So, big warnings.
Right? Yeah, right. Sure.
And that's what we did. And it worked beautiful, you know. BS block is another one which was, I was very fond of. Nowadays, probably most residents haven't even seen one because of the fear. But it worked beautifully. So, but after I stopped doing them, I lost, you know, I don't think I can do even one. So
yeah,
that's
sure.
The way these things are. So although, you know, they have some value to it, but for a candidate who has worked for, you know, years, I mean, had 3 years of residency, obviously, and has, you know, worked for his written component of the course and has done his, you know, structured oral exam. And for that candidate to say fail because he missed 1 or 2 transesophageal echo videos, and then he ends up in waiting for 1 more year. How fair is it? And the same thing with regional anesthesia. Regional, you can still argue that most anesthesiologists should know about regional anesthesia. So, and the ultrasound has become, you know, more or less standard now. That's one point. And the problem is the other 4 very subjective components, you know, being, you know, labeled as objective components. One of them is, you know, they're all based on standardized factors, taking consent of a patient, and then, you know, talking to your colleague. You know, a surgeon might cancel a case, and then you're kind of, you know, sorry, a patient is probably not suitable for anesthesia, and then you have to beg, plead, and make a case with the surgeon, you know, why the case should be canceled. I mean, I honestly find these things doesn't really add any value, you know, whether that or, you know, many of these things, so-called subjective, I mean, objective, but very subjective. So, and many times I've spoken to few candidates, and many times they don't know when they fail, why they fail. And I can see why. Because one, you know, these are standardized actors. We are used to speaking to the real patients, not to the standardized actors. So that makes it hard. And then you have to really act. Whereas in real life, you know, we all have the qualities. And there are so many things that go in. I mean, you and I both know. So one look at the patient, I figure out, you know, how much I'm going to tell him, how I'm going to tell him, what I'm going to tell him. You know, if somebody's extremely anxious, probably they want to know as little as possible. You know, there's some patients who tell me that, doctor, you know your job, just do it. I don't want to know anything. So everything has to be, you know, really tailor-made for individual patients. And obviously, in the stress of the exam, the residents are going to, you know, they also become a standardized anesthesiologist instead of a regular anesthesiologist.
Right.
That doesn't help. And as a result, I thought, you know, I don't think AB has done enough homework, you know, to do this. And let me figure out what the residents think about it. And that way, maybe, you know, ABA might, you know, change their mind. Or who knows, just because if this pandemic goes on for, you know, a couple more years, they might just get rid of
it. Yeah, so it sounds like the OSCE, the goal of it was, of course, having some, like you mentioned, some sort of advanced testing, like you say, with looking at images of ultrasound of, you know, transesophageal echoes or whatever. But it's more like, here's what the practical day-to-day applications of, you know, interacting with colleagues. You have to cancel cases. You have to do uncomfortable things like tell a patient they're going to go under an anesthesia. You're going to put them into a medically induced coma and then bring them back, right? I mean, how do you do these things? And I feel like it is, like you said, it is. They're forcing you to act and not be yourself, right? Because you can't be yourself. You can't read the patient and know what they want, because there are absolutely patients who want to know everything and patients who want to know nothing. Like, and I'll start talking to people, and I can just tell right away. I totally understand. I'm just going to give you a real brief version. You don't get on the airplane and ask the pilot to fly at 30,000 feet. You just want to get on the plane and get to Los Angeles. You don't care how you get there. You just want to get there safely. And I understand that. And I'll just tell you, you know, why you might have a sore throat or something like that. And so, you know, one of the – what you sort of alluded to earlier is you said, you know, there are, of course, biases, because some people just aren't good in acting situations, right? It's all artificial, like – working on a simulator is kind of artificial too, right? It's not a real patient. It's a piece of plastic in front of you. But also, you know, you have to, like you said, there's a testing location. You have to get there. If you're in Los Angeles or if you're in Hawaii or Alaska, you've got to fly all the way to wherever it is, spend a lot of money. And for a test that is, you know, I mean, we could all argue with a written test that's fairly objective, where they're usually right and wrong answers. It's pretty hard to know what those what's right and wrong in a test like this, right?
Exactly. Especially if the ABA is not willing to give feedback. You know how the ABA works, right? I'm sure you know that. If you don't pass an exam, for example, you have to pay some $200, $250 for rescoring. It is not, they get an independent, another panel of examiner to look at the video. They just add up the numbers. Really? I mean, okay, you know, ABA is a rich organization now. I mean, if you look at the, yes. I have it on the, you know, on my paper. I think 2018 they made $19 million or something. That's big. And one of their argument is, after I published this study, one of the Medscape reporter wanted to cover the story. And I spoke to them, and then the reporter contacted the ABA. Secretary. I'm not going to take the name. And then the Medscape never published the story. So I was wondering what happened. A week passed, 2 weeks passed, and nothing happened. And I contacted them again. I said, sorry, we contacted the secretary and this is the response he sent. And I was kind of surprised with all the falsehood they made. I mean, I just couldn't believe the false statement. I'm not going to the details again. Factual errors, and they're not kind of oversight errors. I mean, for me, they look deliberate. Maybe the ABA secretary, you know, has a job to safeguard the interest of the ABA. No, I don't have any problems with that. But then at the same time, you expect somebody at that position to be, you know, ethical and professional the way, you know, which is all ASCII is about in the way they responded. And then I mean, I was obviously upset. And then but the ABA didn't expect me to get this response because, you know, it was sent to them and they never thought I'm going to get a hand onto this. And when I got the hand onto this, I did write back to the ABA, you know, the managing director. And she initially tried to defend, and one of the defense was, well, I mean, some of the mistakes were pretty elementary. One of them was, well, you only sent the emails to a quarter of the residents. No, I had actually sent to about three quarters. And then they said, no, your response is only 5%. No, my response was 17.2%. For any online study nowadays, 17.2% is a pretty good response.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah.
Especially if it's coming from across the country. I mean, I had 42 provinces, you know, including states and two Washington and Puerto Rico. That was good response. But for the ABA to, you know, get to that kind of silliness, I would say, I found it surprising. And I did tell them, I find it surprising that maybe, you know, in your calculation, the number of residents is times what it is. I'm not aware of, because that's not what I found when I looked at the data. They said, no, I mean, we were in a hurry, you know, as a result, we, you know, that mistake has happened. And then I wrote back and I said, come on, a elementary school student can do, you know, 720 divided by 4,200, you know, as a percentage. It doesn't require, you know, much mathematical knowledge. And I don't know how much time it was given. This was important thing I told him. I don't know how much time you were given, but in an exam, whether it is ASCII or oral boards, a candidate gets few seconds to formulate a plan and present the plan. If they make a mistake, you can't go back. Right. They probably know very well the right answer, but given the situation, the time, you know, the stress at the exam, candidates do make mistakes, but you don't give them a chance. And here you're saying that, you know, because you were in a hurry, you made such a silly mistake. Anyway, they sent an apology to me afterwards, and which is a big deal, I guess, for the ABA president to apologize.
Yeah. And I guess we should probably just point out, too, that you know, this study that you mentioned, it'll be linked to on the show notes page at theparadox.com/157. We'll also have a link to the article, Is It Time to Rethink the OSCE? But specifically about your study, we kind of alluded to it, but we haven't mentioned it, is that you surveyed residents and also program directors, and then you got the very high response rate of 17%. If anyone knows who does an online survey, I mean, anything upwards over 5% is actually pretty impressive. And so over 10% is really remarkable. So to get that high a response rate suggests either that they were very bored, and most residents usually aren't that bored, or that they're very upset. they have strong feelings about it, right? And so that's where you get responses like that. And so I guess just clearly the residents were not happy about this. And one could say, well, residents never want extra testing. They never want to do extra work. I mean, who does? No one wants to do more stuff, pay more money to do another test, right? But I think, you know, A, you found that they thought there was no value to this. But also that you did test program directors, and their response rate was not that dissimilar from residents, right?
The program director study actually came from the ABA.
Okay.
And they published it in Journal of Clinical Anesthesia. But, you know, not surprisingly, in their conclusions, in abstract, they didn't even mention the findings. They highlighted the fact that because of the OSCE, there were curriculum changes. They downplayed the other two components, which I highlighted. Well, you know, there's politics everywhere, but there shouldn't be politics here. And you're right, the program directors felt the same thing, and it doesn't add any value. And now what is the data to show that these certifications mean anything? I mean, I just replied to somebody there. ABA has been in existence for over 80 years, almost 83 years, right? In 1938, they started. It started as a voluntary, having a coffee breakfast kind of thing, which became certification. And then it slowly evolved into what it is now.
So I guess we have a test right now that we've decided is probably not adding my value. It's now gone from two components to now three components now to finish your certification.
Yeah.
Anyone who is in practice is going through the recertification process. The components that continue to get added, which I think most people argue don't add a whole lot of value to your clinical practice, except send more money to the American Board of Anesthesiology or to the American Society of Anesthesiology because you're paying for CME components that are specifically, you know, certain criteria that actually qualify for your recertification process. And so, you know, it wouldn't take much of a cynic to say, well, you know, most of the stuff they're doing, we can't really determine that there's any value to it, but except that it provides a financial value benefit to the American Board of Anesthesiology that they can charge really whatever they want, because it's not like you're going to go through your residency and say, well, I'm not going to pay this last little bit, you know, that they added in. And so, I mean, what do you say to that? I mean, I don't think that's a totally unreasonable sort of viewpoint to say they're adding these things that, you know, to your point, they never really showed that it had any value to begin with, or they've never had longitudinal studies, right, showing that people are better or cancel cases are better.
To finish what I started earlier on, the ABA has been in existence for, you know, 80 years. That is sufficient time for them to do some study.
Yeah.
And that one study did come out of Penn many years ago in 2002. Dr. Longnecker, who was the chair of the department, was a senior author. But, you know, that's, they compared the 30-day mortality among the anesthesiologists who were board certified versus non-board certified. And, you know, first of all, we're looking at 30-day mortality. I mean, unless you can demonstrate a direct link that something which is caused by the anesthesiologist because of lack of knowledge or applying that knowledge, which in turn ended up in morbidity and mortality, you cannot really say. And the authors themselves said that non-board certified anesthesiologists worked in less desirable hospitals, which is probably the biggest factor which might explain 30-day mortality. So that's one thing. And as a result, they moved away from, you know, trying to show that and don't forget, ABA has to show that it adds value. The reason being, if you go on the ABA website, one of the missions of the ABA, or I guess the reason they get their, you know, nonprofit status, is their mission is to improve the patient lives, patient care, patient outcome. So if that is their primary goal, don't you think in these 82 years, they could have come up with something better way of showing it if they did it? So as a result, what they did in the last about 7-8 years, they tried to, you know, show, again, that's, you know, very flawed study to show that disciplinary proceedings against anesthesiologists by the medical boards are less in somebody who did the oral exam or who passed the oral exam compared to somebody who didn't pass the oral exam. But then only 1/3 of these were related to your oral exam, you know, pass or not. The remaining 2/3 were related to things like, you know, drug abuse, alcohol, fraud. And moreover, that's not the reason you do ABA certification, to reduce your risk of, you know, licensing. And pretty much, you know, any American ABMS board which has tried to show the value of their, you know, board certification has gone in this direction. Maybe it's relatively easy to do because it's easy to get the data. But then we're not interested in that. because we know that, you know, that the licensing doesn't depend on that.
Right.
What you learn doesn't really, you know, both certified anesthesiologists, I know people who got into, you know, fraud, drugs, alcohol, and lost their license. So that shouldn't be the way, you know, they do things. I understand it is hard, you know, to demonstrate something like that, but it's not impossible. So and another thing they must answer, they must address is the bias, which the psychiatry did address in a way back in 2016. They started working on it from 2008. And if the ABA argues the purpose of, you know, objective structural clinical examination and even structural oral exam for that matter is to test somebody's, you know, communication and professionalism skills, which specialty needs it more than any other specialty? Psychiatry, you agree with me?
Yeah, sure.
Psychiatrists need it, yeah. You know, more than anybody else. And they got rid of it. They got rid of it because they found out, you know, the language, cultural barriers affect the result of the exam. And at the minimum, what I suggest is, you know, I'm not saying that they should, you know, abandon, you know, structured oral exam has definitely value. And who knows, OSCE might have value, but they should demonstrate it. But at the minimum, they should have the video evidence at least presented to the candidate so that he can learn from his mistakes. At the minimum, they're not doing that. And that's not difficult to do nowadays.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, one could argue that part of the residency process is not actually, it is actually obviously to gain skills, it's to gain knowledge and to, you know, understand deeper your specialty and the ins and outs of it. There's clearly that's the case. But there's more to it than that, right? And the things that there are those, you know, the sort of the social skills that you learn, ability to communicate with your colleagues, talking to the other services, explaining why you should or shouldn't do something. You know, when you have the ophthalmologist who tells you, hey, the patient's moving during a cataract, can you give him some muscle relaxants? How do you, you know, not tell them that you can't paralyze someone if they're breathing on their own, right? Like, you know, those sorts of things, I mean, make great stories. But to, like, you know, work with your colleagues. And, you know, it seems to me that if you feel like if you're a residency program and you are credentialed, whatever we decide the credentialing process, those things should sort of be assumed, right? And that to try and objectively determine those through some other test is probably kind of, it's probably a fool's, you know, fool's errand to try and actually find those things, right? Because if we either say, you know, you went to Harvard, you went to, you know, UPenn, University of Iowa, I did. Our assumption is that you're going to be a reasonable person and that those programs will have removed you or taught you or said, you know, this just is the wrong job for you or something like that. And it seems like this sort of program, this testing regime is not really going to do anything besides either reaffirm what we already know, that the program's doing what it's supposed to do, or, you know, that you have some sort of problem just for cultural reasons, like you said, maybe you just, the person's like, this guy seems weird or whatever, that it just punishes people for unduly. And I, mm-hmm. and if you say, well, everybody passes, which maybe some people would say most people do, well, then what's the point in doing it at all if everyone's passing, right? Because then now you're just collecting it. You're just having me send you a check, right? I mean, that's really all, that's all you're doing.
That's exactly what happened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you're right. I mean, if somebody has gone through this rigorous, you know, 4 years of residency process, you know, and, you know, they've been, you know, so, I mean, the program director certifies them, you know, they get through the program. They should be good enough to do all these basic things. They know how to communicate to the patient. And if you want to do that, you know, I don't know, Australia used to do that. Maybe it's, but again, you know, the logistics will be tough, is to maybe get an examiner and ask him to observe the actual anesthesia that's being done, both from the preoperative in a point, intra and post-op. Because that way you can see the real performance of the candidate, the real patient, which is hard to do, but, you know, at least it is a better way of doing it. But I have great reservations with standardized actors.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think, you know, if you want to just look at a regular, let's say, undergraduate education, somebody gets their degree in biology, they don't have further testing and things they do afterwards. You have your degree in biology, and then you go, you either maybe you've done an internship. There are other sort of things that are used to determine whether you're a good candidate or someone who's good in the field. And I mean, I guess in some ways you say, well, the only experience and life experience is going to sort of weed people out who are good people in that field or not. And, you know, I can add other tests ahead of time, but the only thing, once my rubber meets the road, is really where you find out this person is capable, can it, right? That's why when we have people who are grads, they come and they interview with us because we assume that they know the basic, you know, knowledges and whatever, but we talk to, we get letters of recommendation written by faculty about the person. Maybe we know someone in this faculty who knows this person and can tell us if they are good or bad, if they've got problems. I mean, that's how you, I mean, that's just the real world. And so I don't, I guess it seems like the ABA is sort of like trying to do a interview process when in fact, all they really should be focusing on is whether someone is safe or unsafe, right? I think, you know, if someone is like totally lacking knowledge or they're someone who can safely do the job.
Exactly.
Not whether they're a great guy, you want to have a beer with them or something, but it should be just, yeah. Are you someone who can, is capable of doing the job? Because maybe your that person doesn't fit in with my group, but they may fit in with another group. Just like I may fit in with this examiner, and maybe I don't sometimes, but it doesn't mean I'm the wrong person sometimes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, you know. Square peg in a square hole.
So like one of the things we talked about a lot in the show, too, is we have these quasi-governmental agencies. And so the American Board of Anesthesiology is one of these such groups. And the ABMS would be an example. Any of the specialty boards would be this, where they are private. So you can't – there's no, like, legislation you can pass to change the rules. But we're sort of beholden to them as specialists. Like we have really no power, and it's not like you can go to the, you know, the North American Board of Anesthesiology. There's only the ABA. There's no other place to get certified, which makes the studies to what your point was, that very few people who are not board certified who can find jobs anywhere. Because if you can, it's like you said, you're at a kind of a low class hospital or something like that. And so it's the counterfactual to prove like these guys aren't dangerous. Well, or because everybody pretty much is board certified who's working anesthesia. So you can't really like even have any sort of reasonable study with, you know, matching cohorts of, you know, people who have training or whatever. And so with the ABA, I guess to your point, they had this test, they had no pilot study. They just said, hey, we're going to do this. We'll see how it goes. And then, I don't know, even if they got feedback, how do you know that they care what your feedback is? I mean, what sort of power do physicians have? In this case, anesthesiologists, but it could be any specialty board, right? They could just launch something. What power do we have to say that this is not a good idea? Because it seems to me that there's nothing we can do because they control the certification process, whether we can work or not.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a hard one, right? I mean, that's what they take advantage of. You know, it is a voluntary, mandatory exam.
It's like the IRS, right? You can send us your taxes. You don't have to, but if you don't, you'll go to jail.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, they should first realize themselves. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, come on, they've gone through the same process, you know, as you and me. You know, the board directors are all anesthesiologists. They know what they're doing. And in fact, you know, I was speaking to one of the director, and again, I'm not going to tell the names. And before they, you know, started this process of asking, one of the directors, in fact, raised the question, how many of you guys among the directors, I think there are 10, 12 of them, are capable of, you know, passing these transistors, if it's an echo or ultrasound? Not many,
yeah.
Unless they were doing cardiac anesthesia. Well, you can argue, you know, once you pass the exam, you don't have to know about it. But then, you know, if you're a director of a board trying to establish some new norm and bring in something new, I think it's reasonable to expect that they should know it themselves. At least, I mean, you know, that's my opinion. But your question is, how can you change it? Well, I mean, I hope I made some beginning, at least, you know, I made people to think. And, you know, if more and more people think, and I have another IRB approved study looking at, you know, other aspects of the ABA functioning, and probably that study, you know, the questionnaire survey will be going up in the next 6 months or so. So that, I mean, the very fact, you know, if that's the case, if what you're saying is true, ABA should have just ignored my survey altogether, right?
Sure.
There was no need for them to lie to the Medscape, criticizing my study. If I'm nobody, if they think, you know, who cares, you know,
right,
this guy is nothing, you know, if he's just barking at us, you know, we're a huge elephant, who cares? If that's the case, they could have told the Medscape people, you know what, we don't respond to those kind of studies. So obviously they care.
Yeah.
Obviously they care what the residents, you know, think. USMLE, you know, finally they had to, I mean, the pandemic came as well, but they did, you know, got rid of their exam, which was not serving any purpose, you know, which was biased, which was questioned for many years, both by, you know, American graduates and foreign American graduates, and they finally got rid of it. So if you know, if residents and doctors, you know, keep putting pressure, and I'm sure, but I mean, there are other legal ways of doing it, you know, sending representation to the, you know, state legislatures and things like that, and working that way. But who has time and effort? And yeah, the problem is most of the people, once they get certified, they don't care to look into that, right?
Yeah, well,
which is kind of incorrect, because see, maybe because I'm in academic center and I have unique interest in looking at the bias. This is not the first time I looked at a study involving bias. There's a paper I published in 2018. I mean, I have about 80 Medline Index publications, but my main focus of research is GI endoscopy anesthesia. That's where I did most of the, you know, sedation related studies. And my papers, including in a meta-analysis, retrospective, prospective studies, they used to go into something like 2 to 3 impact factor GI journals. Some of them have been extensively cited. But whenever I sent to, you know, anesthesia or similar journal, they got rejected. And I was wondering, you know, why? I mean, obviously they want, you know, something like this to be widely read. They want citations, you know, to improve the impact factor. Why they're rejecting it? Then I looked at the editorial board and looked at their publications. I said, huh. So if you're an editorial board member, you have a better chance of getting published in the same journal. Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be blind, right? But then I started looking at the data. I looked at the publications of first 5 editorial board members in the top 5 highest impact factor anesthesiology and gastroenterology journals. I mean, one expects, even if you are in the ANA editorial board, would you not like to get it published in anesthesiology, which has higher impact factor? If you are, same thing with, you know, Journal of Clinical Anesthesia was even lower, and, you know, anesthesia, the Britain was lower. So anybody probably likes to aim at a higher one. But I found results not totally surprising. The p-value for editorial board member publishing in anesthesia and anesthesia, their own journal, was something like ridiculous, 0.01 or something. So I found that if you're an editorial board member, you have a pretty high chance of getting into the same journal. And strangely, majority of the OSCE-related papers, there are quite a few of them, they're all published in ANA.
Interesting.
And I asked the ANA editor, I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense. Why everything is coming to your journal? Don't they find anesthesiology more interesting? I mean, that's higher impact factor. So that's one thing I looked at. And the second thing I again looked at in 2020 was, you know, how this hype that most of the doctors were dying because of COVID or anesthesiologists, intensive care doctors, you know, emergency room doctors. And but then when I started looking at the data, I really didn't see it. Then I, you know, studied the Medscape data, and then surprisingly, I found the group which died most were family doctors, which is surprising.
Yeah.
Not anesthesiologists. In fact, the death rates among anesthesiologists were same as psychiatrists, which is very surprising. In fact, Penn used the data to formulate the plan as to who gets vaccination first. So I've done this kind of, you know, this is not the first time I looked at the bias.
Yeah.
So that's what one of the reasons I started looking at this. But how can you change it? I think people have to be on the thing, not just one person. You know, more than one person has to do it. And that's what I'm hoping. As I go along, probably get more people involved and giving the interview with somebody like you on your podcast is probably going to help to spread the message. You probably saw my anesthesiology news article and the Oximity. Yeah, I mean, I hope I can, you know, keep pushing it forward.
Yeah, well,
until at least they make it, at least they start providing the video evidence to the candidates. At least they should do that. There's no reason why they shouldn't.
Sure. Well, you know, I suppose you could argue they just need to maintain they are private and they probably have to maintain the image that they actually care. You know, that's why they do care about their image, right, in the public. And they've seen what's happened to the American Board of Internal Medicine, which has had a public relations disaster. I mean, I would almost say their criminal operation in some ways. They were pretty close in a lot of what was disclosed about ABIM, and maybe it's not technically criminal, but it was certainly not very ethical in a lot of what they did, and lots of physicians were rightly upset about it. But not a whole lot's been done. I mean, you know, the leadership's still there at ABIM, and we are very much, you know, it's golden handcuffs, right? We just can't really shake these organizations. And so, but to your point also earlier that the psychiatry board dropped one of their examinations, and so it's entirely possible that they could radically change or drop one of them. Maybe they drop, you know, the oral boards and have the OSCE instead.
Yeah, there's no accountability. I agree. In fact, I asked the ABA, you know, do you have anything called, you know, ombudsperson? They said no. Are you accountable to ABMS? No. ABA is not accountable to ABMS.
Yet they have a component they add on because the ABM has told us we had to, because we decided we have to add this, you know, level 5 components. I can't remember the part 5 or something like that for MOC, for major certification, because that's what everyone else is doing. But then I'll see my wife's board say, well, we're doing this because this is what the anesthesiologists are. I'm like, oh, great. We're like a bad example for people to add more, you know, more components on. And, you know, we look at the before even COVID, we looked at high burnout rates. We had high suicide rates, the highest of any profession within medicine. I mean, outside of dentistry or something, but actually within the medical profession, we're the highest. It's not just because of certification process, but certainly doesn't help. And especially when you're doing things that are, I mean, as you said, a little bit subjective, right? Like, are you communicating well with that person? Well, I thought I convinced that person, but he's acting. I don't know. Maybe he didn't think I did a good job. I don't know. And so, it's frustrating for me because I feel like a lot of times there's no recourse for you. There's no other alternative, you know, board you can go to. There's no sort of there's not even a representative that you can go talk to for the ABA, right? I mean, the American Society of Anesthesiology, well, you technically have reps and they go and they do, you know, they have, or go to AMA. They're people who are representing you in your district. There's nothing like that ABA. It's just this sort of board of, I think they're almost all academics, almost always, who are pulling down a lot of money, I mean, to do whatever it is they do. I mean, at least the only good thing I could say about the ABA is that they're not making the same salaries as the ABIM or the ABP, where those guys are pulling down 7 figures, and, you know, which is 2 to 3 times what their colleagues are doing on the ground, right, who they're apparently credentialing. So,
I think you are right at the end of the day. They do care for the image.
Yeah.
It's all about image, right? And if more and more people start questioning that, if more and more people start questioning the value of the exam and, you know, whether it makes any difference in patient care, then they have to care.
Yeah, I mean, you think so. I mean, their authority, I guess, comes from the image from hospitals and credentialing organizations like, oh, well, if they say it's important, then it must be important, whatever. And if there are a bunch of people questioning that, these hospitals might say, maybe it's not important or something. So I guess that would be our only recourse is to, you know, put as much data as we can, which is what you've done, expose the problems and the potential biases that are involved with this system, and then question it, I guess, and hopefully keep people engaged, which, you know, everyone's busy and doing other things. And to your point too, that once you're done with your residency, you're like, I don't want to, I'm done with that board. I'm done. I don't want to think about it again. But I didn't even know, I mean, not in academics, I'm sort of peripherally involved with academics, but I didn't even know about this test existing. So just You know, so it just shows you how disengaged you become after you leave the rest of the training part. I mean, that's really sort of the part of it. So you actually also, in kind of shift of topics, but you run iatroboards.com. Mm-hmm. And so that is a, and this is why I know you're plugged into sort of the testing thing and credentialing, which helps people with USMLE questioning and anesthesia boards. Can you briefly say what that was and what made you start this that project?
Well, that has been something I've been thinking for a long, long time, for almost 20, 25 years. And, you know, I've been thinking about these questions and I've been kind of, you know, writing them and collecting them. And I somehow decided to, you know, put it across. It didn't come as any specific reason or specific purpose. It's something you can say my lifelong ambition to have something like that.
To help people,
nothing more than
to
that.
Help people pass boards, right, is basically what those things are.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does have pass boards. Yeah. But then there are so many of them, right? I mean, you can probably block them.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought about doing my own, but I thought I got other things going on, so I won't do
it. It's a lot of hard work, though.
I've got work. This podcast is plenty for me, so.
I'm planning to put all of them on YouTube as videos, in a 5 minutes or 10 minutes video for each question. Let us see, because that's a lot of work.
Perfect. It could be like the Gudra Academy, sort of just like the Khan Academy. It'd be perfect.
Yeah, just more of a hobby, anything like you do.
Well, Dr. Gudra, I want to thank you so much for being on the Paradox and for introducing us to your study and what you've found out with the OSCME or OSCE. And of course, again, those will all be linked to theparadox.com/157. Dr. Gudra, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Larson. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.